Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
You're listening to Ruthie's Table 4 in partnership with Montclair. There is a well-known cartoon in the New Yorker magazine depicting President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his pajamas, on his knees, next to his bed, saying a prayer for his wife, the most active First Lady in history. Dear Lord, please make Eleanor tired tomorrow. I can imagine the friends and family of Stephen Fry saying the same prayer, for there's very little Stephen doesn't do. Actor, comedian, television host, director, prolific writer with 4 novels, 3 autobiographies, and countless columns in national papers. But should you ask, as I've been doing, the people who know him really well, what Stephen is best at, they will answer being a friend. As for me, I love this man, all he stands for, and quite simply who he is. And I would change FDR's prayer. I would say, Dear Lord, we all need Stephen Fry. Please do not make him tired tomorrow.
Oh, Ruthie, I don't know what to say. I'm going to have to tiptoe out of the room now. I can't possibly live up to such an introduction.
Yes, you can. Bless you. More than. So we're sitting here in the River Cafe in our new Sylvia's dining room. So shall we read the recipe
Let's do that. The
polenta and almond cake?
So here is the recipe, or receipt, as upper-class people used to say. We have torta di polenta, mandorle e limone. Mandorle, of course, is also, you know, those pictures that the Renaissance artist did of a face in a frame that has a point at the top and a point at the bottom, a sort of point. They call that a mandorla because it's the shape of an almond. Yeah. Anyway, torta di polenta, mandorle e limone. Polenta, almond, and lemon cake. This serves 10. All right. So, have you got your pencils out and you're licking them? These first 3 dry ingredients, great, because it's the same quantity. 450 grams of unsalted butter. That's not a dry ingredient, Stephen. Softened. So remember, in the morning, first thing, take the butter out of the fridge. 450 grams of caster sugar. 450 grams of ground almonds. 6 of your finest eggs. The zest of 4 lemons and the juice of 1 lemon. Then 220 grams of polenta flour. 1 teaspoonful of baking powder. I never really know the difference between baking powder and bicarbonate of soda.
There's a huge difference.
There is a huge difference, I'm being told in my ear by my expert. So it's baking powder. Don't substitute with anything else, baking soda or anything. So 1 teaspoonful of baking powder, 1/4 teaspoonful of salt. You will have preheated the oven at this point to 160 degrees centigrade. I would say 140 or 50 fan. Then butter and flour, a 30-centimeter cake tin, which I hope you have lying handily around. Beat the butter and sugar together until it becomes pale and light, and that really does happen. The butter is good British butter, yellow to start with, but it's amazing how, as it beats and beats and the sugar gets released into it, it does become notably lighter, and that's your signal to add the ground almonds. Then you stir to combine them, and then you add the eggs, 1 at a time, and beat the mixture through. Fold in the lemon zest, the lemon juice. The smell will rise up into your nostrils. Then the polenta, which gives the cake its major name, of course, the baking powder and the salt. You spoon the mixture that then is now nice and smooth into your prepared tin, and you bake in the preheated oven for 45 to 50 minutes or until set. I guess the old toothpick taste test will do. And the cake will be deep brown on top. That's a cue. It's delicious on its own, as I can absolutely testify, with a cappuccino, perhaps, or a glass of Vinsanto. And when in season, here, at this place of joy, the River Cafe, it says, "We caramelize blood oranges." Can you imagine? What are you doing this morning, darling? I'm caramelizing some blood oranges.
or eating some blood oranges.
It reminds me of wonderful Les Dawson, the Northern comedian. He said, "Well, I can't stop chapping. I've got a cape on to baste. I've got sausages to prick," and so on. Anyway, I've got blood oranges to caramelize, and you serve that with the cake. Anyway, you just couldn't do better. It's one of the great, great recipes.
I think that if I'd, even in the last 4 minutes, I have now understood that you are a great cook. You're a great eater, but you are, you know, are you a passionate cook? Would you describe yourself?
I do love.
Tell me about cooking.
I had a strange childhood, which was an... It sounds like it's, I don't know, Downton Abbey or something, but it really wasn't. But my parents did have a cook, and we had gardeners, and we had an old-fashioned Victorian kitchen garden. So I was used to the fact that every day the gardeners would come to the back door and Mrs. Riseborough, the cook, would select some of the vegetables or tell them to go off and get something else, depending on what she was cooking. And I would hang around, you know, age five or something, watching her. I'd see her do things like, I mean, she was what used to be called a good English plain cook. Mm. So she didn't do anything terribly fancy, but everything she did was just right. Pies and tarts and things like that she was very good at. And she would take her thumb and put little squares of pastry on it and pull them back to make a rose that would go in the centre of pies and things.
So she had little touches.
And she made pork pies, she made, basically anything that you could make, she made. We had a game larder and things, and so we'd have birds hung and things like that.
Sounds good, Mrs. Riseborough.
She was wonderful.
Amazing. Would they entertain?
Oh, yeah, they were
always... parties, and they were very social.
Yes, my mother would do dinner parties, and when I was young, and up until I was about 12, 14 maybe, there would be dinner jackets and, you know, black tie, and the men would be left alone by the women in the dining room. So that's, you know, that tradition that's still going.
The men stayed,
and the women withdrew.
And
I remember my mother saying, my mother read history. She was a history graduate, and she taught it occasionally. And I would say to her, "Why do the men stay behind?" And I think someone had said to me, "It's so they can tell dirty jokes that the women don't hear." And my mother said, "No, you know what it is, really?" She said, "The Victorians, the women did not like drawing attention to the fact that they had to use lavatories. So if they all went in one go, they would go up to the lavatories, use the lavatories together, and then get down into the drawing room, and they'd be sitting there. But if everybody went into the drawing room together after the meal, and the women said, 'I'm going to go now,' everyone would go, 'Oh, she's off for a piss, is she?' You know." And so it was just a discreet way of women having that chance to do that without being noticed, as it were.
And so your memories are of home and good food and a care for food, do you think?
Yeah, because my mother also had food, I wouldn't say issues, but she would drive the gardeners mad because she'd go out when the peas were ready, and she would just eat the entire crop of peas
out of
the pod. So, yeah, this is
I remember once sitting on a railway train, and we were going from one small town in Italy to another, and we'd gone to the market and bought some peas, and we had children with us, and we were all eating the raw peas on the train carriage. Italians went mad. I mean, the idea of eating a raw pea, those people were sitting at it. We could have taken off all our clothes and had more respect than giving our children raw peas out of. But what's more delicious than raw peas?
Sensational.
That, you know, and we make a salad. Do you ever have raw peas? You know, you can make a salad with delicious.
But the other thing that was natural because of the kitchen garden was everything was in season. So you know, and there were fruit trees, you know, trained against the outbuildings, plum trees and things like that. And there were gooseberry bushes and raspberry and black currants and four fantastic asparagus beds, raised asparagus beds, Belgian asparagus, quite small and delicate asparagus. And my mother had a constant war with the gardeners because, well, she had this theory that you shouldn't eat asparagus after Ascot.
Which is June. Ascot?
Mid-June, something like that? Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, she'd heard that somewhere or been told that. And she, of course, was desperate to get hold of, once the asparagus was getting old, the ferns would come up. And she loved it for flower arranging.
She sounds amazing.
Oh, she is.
I mean, she still is. Sounds like. Yep. She's still here.
Yeah, she's still with us. And she is phenomenal. She's 92.
Yeah. Because that, I do think that inner knowledge and passion for the garden, for the ferns, for the seasonality of saying, and there is a very short season for good asparagus.
I don't know if it's Ascot, but it is.
There is, in Paris, one minute you'd go down to the market and, there were white asparagus and green asparagus and thin asparagus, and then they were gone. I mean, just gone. And I think it's here as well. And they do come from Norfolk.
Yes, they do. Yeah. But the criminal thing now, I think, in some ways, is people don't understand that you can store fresh fruit and vegetables. You know, we had outhouses and there would be newspaper and potatoes. And when you lifted all the potatoes and there they'd be and they'd last all the way through. Mm. As long as it was dark and cool, which it naturally would be being an outhouse, and the same with apples and pears, they last forever.
Your parents were interested in food? Did this come from their cultural...
My mother, yes. My father, lesser. My father just ate everything that was put in front of him, and his mind was on his work. He was a scientist. But my mother was from a Jewish family, and Jews always, compared to the British in those days, less so now, were obsessed with food, partly because in some cases they knew poverty between the wars when things were really short in Vienna and in Hungary where my grandparents came from. My grandfather was a good cook, and I remember... He made the most beautiful sort of dill and cucumber salads and things, and I really got a taste for that kind of Central European flavour from him, things like cucumbers and so on, which are very Central European, Polish and Hungarian and other such things, and spicy but not like Indian or Mexican food spicy, but in that sort of paprika spiciness, which I'm very fond of.
You know, my grandparents were Hungarian. One side were Russian Jews who left Russia, and the other were Hungarian Jews that left Hungary. And they came to the United States as part of the Ellis Island influx in 1915.
So really early.
They got here early. So growing up in this household, you then went away to school at age?
Seven.
And was that a food shock as well as a kind of homesick shock?
It certainly was. We grew up in Norfolk, and obviously my mother wouldn't force me to eat anything I hated. And I arrived at this prep school, age seven, which is in Gloucestershire, 200 miles away.
What year was this?
This was in 1964. And there are things like semolina and tapioca, hot milk puddings. Something about milk that's been boiled makes me actually makes me a dry heave. Yeah. And I saw these and I said, no, I can't. And they forced it, literally holding my nose like a hunger strike thing. It was cruel in those days. But, of course, you know, it happened to other boys, so you just think this is life. But I really, and I forced myself to throw up at the table so that they stopped doing it. You forced yourself. And it was written down, Stephen Fry, or Fry S, probably, or Fry Jr., because my brother was there, allergic to hot milk.
Clever. So I mean, a good defensive reaction to figure out what to do.
Yeah. But it was, I mean, it was, I wouldn't say Dickensian, but it was a world of chilblains and constipation and cold, you know. I mean, the way they heated a dormitory was just to have a hot pipe running along the bottom, you know, no radiators or anything. And so it wasn't...
Did you miss the food desperately?
Yeah. I mean, and
Mrs.
they...
Mrs. Risebrough.
Yes, very much so. What it does, I've spoken about this before, and what it does is you start to obsess about sweets. There's a tuck shop in the school. They're called a tuck shop. Tuck is the school slang for goodies, for confectionery. And you start to get really obsessed with when the tuck shop's going to be open and how much pocket money you've got to buy these things. And this was the golden age of confectionery. Cadbury was producing new things like Curly Whirly and Aztec bars, and there were these amazing, you know, foam shrimps and flying saucers made of rice paper and fruit salads, four for a penny, and blackjacks, four for a penny. And I became so obsessed that I would start breaking out of school bounds and going to the village shop. This was in Gloucestershire, a little village called Ewley. And I would spend whatever money I had on getting those sweets. And it became a kind of obsession that my teeth suffered. By the time I was 12, I was having huge amounts of fillings and even having teeth out. But also, what was interesting, and I'm not using this as an excuse, but a lot of it was preparation for smoking. There were these coconut shredded brown fake tobaccos in a little wax paper with a Spanish galleon on it, which was like rolling tobacco. There were these candy cigarettes that you would have.
I remember candy. We had chocolate ones in America.
Yes, that's it.
And they were gold top.
In sort of fake Chesterfield packs, soft packs.
Looked exactly like Chesterfield
or something, cigarettes. Or Camel. And licorice pipes. And so they were getting you ready.
Pipes, what, licorice pipes?
Well, like a pipe smoker's pipe, but made out of a licorice, yeah. And even more sort of weirdly, the glamour of the white powder, sherbet. So you'd suck it up through a licorice straw in a sherbet fountain. So it was preparing you for a life to come.
Yeah.
So you'd then go from the, you know, when you were 14 or 15, you'd go for the real cigarettes and smoking. And then when you're a little bit older than that, the real white powder. It's a terrible thought. I'm not excusing it or saying that it was the school's fault that I in later life did become something of an addict.
I was even, not to interrupt your story,
but I was going
to say that culturally, if your parents were Hungarian Jews, or background of that. Did going to boarding school come easy to them?
So my parents had both boarded all their time as children, so there was there was nothing. And you have to remember, if you're thinking how cruel to send a child away at the age of seven, if that seven-year-old child has other friends, as I did in the Norfolk countryside, they were all boys who were also going to prep school.
Yeah.
And then when you get to the prep school, obviously everyone's in the same boat. So you just think, this is what life is like. You don't think, this is so unfair. There are people who are not going to boarding schools. You just think,
this is another discussion. You might not think it. The child might not think it, but the parents might think it.
Yes, and I was aware that because we would go, my mother and I, from Norwich by train, and we'd have breakfast on the train, you know.
What would you have on the train? Tell me about the breakfast.
Oh, it was so good because they had these silver, they did silver service. They had stewards in short white little tops, tunics, whatever you'd say. And they would, you know, the silver service in the sense they'd use a spoon and a fork in the same hand. And they could deftly put the bacon and the fried egg on a train, exactly. And we got to know them. Then they would recognize us and say, oh, school again, young man, is it? And all that, you know. Anyway, we'd get the train and then we'd spend a day in London. Sometimes we'd have lunch with my grandfather at the, usually at the Waldorf or the
Waldorf
Savoy.
Hotel.
Yeah, that sort of area. He liked the Waldorf.
That was in the Aldwych, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right, with the big palm court.
Yeah, there you go in there. That's right, you go. They had dances.
I think they did.
When I first came again to London, they had the Thé Dansant.
That's it. Yeah, nice hotel. And then go to Paddington, and that's where my heart would start to sink and flutter a bit, because you'd see at the end of the platform boys in these straw hats that we call boaters, and that was the school compartment. But then you'd notice, or I'd notice, that my mother was crying. You know, she was trying not to. So touching. It's making me move now because, you know, everyone thinking how cruel of parents, but they don't want to lose their child, but they just feel that's the right thing for them.
You stayed in school till... Oh.
Ah, well, now we don't have enough time to cover the chapters of disaster, do we? I went from prep school. Prep school in England is age 7, which is the youngest, and to 13. And then you would take what was called a common entrance exam, which was for public schools, i.e. private schools. And so I went to a private school called Uppingham. And my behavior was dreadful. And then, worst of all, I fell in love with a boy, and I was so confused by this, so absolutely astonished by the power of the emotion, the sheer power that you could be obsessed for 24 hours a day and think of nothing else and change your walking habits so you would bump into this person and knowing... I mean, just phenomenal obsession. Not really sexual, even. I was, you know, just something overwhelming.
Was it reciprocated?
Eventually, there was a nice moment. It threw me completely and certainly threw my concentration away. But the actual casus belli, as I think one should say, the cause of the war, the originating disaster, was I was a member, the youngest member, of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. And I got permission from my housemaster to go to a meeting of the society in London in some grand club. And I read a paper. I delivered a paper, and the idea was that I was staying overnight at the club, and the next morning I would take a train back to school. Well, the next morning, I went to a cinema. In those days, cinemas would sort of start a program at 10 in the morning or something, and then just you could stay in the same cinema and watch the same film again and again. And the film was Cabaret, and I was completely obsessed with it. I'd just never seen anything like it. It was fantastic.
Yeah, and you then, just chose it.
Randomly, not knowing what it was, anything about it, not knowing, you know, about Christopher Isherwood or Liza Minnelli or any of the sort of background to it. And then I wandered in a daze to another cinema, and there was A Clockwork Orange was on. And fortunately, I was, although I was 14 and a half, I could pass as X, which was 18, I guess, and because being tall, I suppose. And so there were three or four films, I think The Godfather as well, and Fritz the Cat, which was a sort of pornographic cartoon.
Remember Fritz the Cat?
Do you remember it? Yeah. Fritz the Cat. Yeah. So 4 days passed.
You stayed 4 days?
Yes.
And was anybody out searching for you?
Yes, and they were terrified, and they didn't know what had happened to me, and they'd run away, what's going on? And then I kind of came to in a sort of daze and went back to the school where there was a lot of folded arms and tapping of feet on the carpet. And
did anybody call the police?
Oh, they had done, yes. They'd reported me as missing after 3 days, I think, whatever it was. So it was just a disaster. And I remember getting in the car with my parents, because I was expelled from the school, and my father saying the words, "We will talk about this sorry incident when we get home."
Sorry incident.
Sorry incident. I remember that. For it was a sorry incident.
Did you know the River Cafe has a shop? It's full of our favorite foods and designs. We have cookbooks, linen napkins, kitchenware, tote bags with our signatures, glasses from Venice, chocolates from Turin. You can find us right next door to the River Cafe in London or online at shoptherivercafe.co.uk. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With summer fast approaching, life tends to get busy. Seeing family, friends, hosting dinners, barbecues, picnics in the park, and everything else that comes between. What's also important is that we find time for ourselves to rest and recharge. Therapy can be a vital tool to assist you with boundaries and managing your schedule in a way that helps you stay happy and healthy. If you're looking to find a new therapist or start therapy for the first time, BetterHelp is worth a try. It's entirely online, which makes it easy, accessible, and flexible with your schedule. Completing a short questionnaire will match you to the right licensed therapist for you. If it's not working, you can change for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
When you went to Cambridge, what was the food like there? Then you were away from both the boarding school and you were away from your parents. Could you create your own food world more?
Yes. There were some students that one got friendly with who really understood food.
Mm. Did you cook for yourself at Cambridge, or was that hard if you were in college?
You had your rooms, and you had what was called a gyp room, which was like a little kitchen, but it didn't really have a proper oven or anything. So you couldn't do much there. But in because of the acting, I would, in particular, after the May term, which was like the summer term at Cambridge, when it was over, I would stay on to rehearse with friends all the plays we were taking up to Edinburgh. And then one might stay at totally different places, and I stayed with them rather than in your college, because your college would be given over to conferences and things like that, and they wouldn't let you stay there. So I remember staying with friends, and one of these friends, Ben, who was really good, he taught me the mirepoix, the preparation for almost anything, you know, the carrots, the celery, and chopping them up.
Italian cooking sofrito.
Sofrito, exactly. And is the basis of everything from bolognese upwards, as it were. And so I really enjoyed learning that and seeing how all that worked. And he showed me as well what I now know is called deglazing, you know, how you had, I'd say, oh, everything's stuck. And he goes, no, just take a glass of wine and just throw it on. And I'm going, what are you doing? And then it would all just come to life. And, you know, he had that confidence.
So was he really the first person to teach
he
you?
He kind of was, yeah. Yeah. He taught me not to be afraid or and not to have to follow every syllable on a page, because once you knew the principle of certain kinds of cooking, you could just then do very, oh, we haven't got any of that, we'll use fish instead. But it says it's for lamb. Yeah. So that's all right, you know. And he'd just sort of take the heat
out. As I always say, cooking is a bit like poetry, you know. You have to know the real poetry to go to free verse.
Yes, exactly. Once you know the 14 lines on it, you can then escape the prison of the form. But it was really when I left Cambridge, I was so fortunate because, you know, our comedy stuff I was doing with Hugh Laurie and Emma Thompson won a prize.
What was the comedy stuff?
Well, it was Cambridge has this club called the Footlights, which is well over 100 years old, and it sort of specializes in comedy. I say it is whoever the undergraduates are at the time who happened to be members of the club. But it famously had Peter Cook and John Cleese and Eric Idle and Griffiths Jones and Douglas Adams and Clive James and all
Stephen
kinds of...
Stephen Fry.
Miriam Margolyes.
And
yes.
Stephen Fry.
And then Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie and Emma Thompson. We were all one sort of bunch. And we went to Edinburgh and we won this new prize called the Perrier Award for Comedy. And this involved going to Australia. Well, sort of. The prize didn't. But because we won it, an Australian entrepreneur called Michael Edgeley saw our show and then said, you guys want to come over to Australia? And that's where I learned to eat, because, Ruthie, it was an absolute revelation.
Sydney?
This is 1981. Starting in Sydney, Doyle's, of course, the amazing seafood place. You walk along the dunes and come to this beautiful shack where the food is, where things you've never heard of, like barramundi and Moreton Bay bugs and all these extraordinary seafood things. But also... oysters. I mean, oysters so plentiful and not, oh my goodness, I'm having oysters. I must be in Bentley's or in, you know, some posh, you know, London restaurant that does oysters. But it was, have some oysters, mate. I'll have mine. Rockefeller, you know, or Kilpatrick. Mm. You know, these different ways of preparing them. Kilpatrick, of course, a favourite of mine because it involved Worcestershire sauce.
Back to the Worcestershire sauce.
Yes. Yeah. So I became really obsessed with oysters and would have,
so they
you
were
know,
cooked if they
and
had
And they
bacon.
Were cheap. Sometimes you could, that's the point. I'd have some plump, half a dozen plump Pacific oysters not cooked, and then half a dozen cooked Mornay, Rockefeller, and Kilpatrick with the
which
different
is the
ways.
One with the bacon, the Kilpatrick.
That's the Kilpatrick, And they were cheapest chips, as people say. Mm. So wine was the other thing. I finally moved off the Lambrusco.
Yeah, we haven't talked about wine.
Yeah, because they had things like Grange Hermitage, which at the time was good, but nothing like as expensive as it is now. £300 or £400 a bottle, at least, isn't it? But they had this way of categorizing wines, which is so ridiculously obvious, but was unheard of in Britain.
What was it?
By grape, i.e. varietal. Yeah. So they would say this is a Shiraz, you know, and this is a Cabernet Sauvignon, this is a Semillon, whatever, and. They'd tell you about the grape, and you go, oh, I see. Then you get back to England, and every restaurant just says Chateau Neuf to this, Chateau that, and you go, what does that mean? But when I got back to England...
How long were you in Australia?
We were, like, for 2 months.
And travelling everywhere.
Travelling everywhere, all the big cities and some of the crazy little towns like Albury, Wodonga, eating fabulous food, cheaply and happily. And the whole day really was around the fact we'd finished the show and what restaurant we're going to. But when I got back to England, I was wandering around Soho. We were doing a TV show and I was feeling lucky and flush with cash relatively compared to being a student, but not very rich. And I was wandering around Soho and I was getting lost, as you do before you understand what's the cross street and, you know. And so I was going down this street called Greek Street and I saw an attractive-looking restaurant. And the restaurant was called L'Escargot, the snail.
The snail.
And I wandered in, and this fabulous woman, about 3 foot tall, came up to me and said, hello, dear. And I said, I was obviously very nervous. She said, you come with me. And she sat me down. You'll know who I'm talking about, Eleanor Salvatini, this amazing woman, phenomenal. And she sat me down and I said, I'm not... And she chose for me, somehow brilliantly, things that were just cheap enough for me to be able to afford. And so from then on, the richer I got, the luckier I got, I would go there. And this was in the high days of Lescargot. We know Princess Diana would go and all these people. But most importantly, again, it was... Jancis Robinson's husband, Lander, his name was
Nick Lander,
who ran Lescargot. And Jancis Robinson's great wine critic, great first woman to be made a master of wine, fabulous person. And she made the wine list varietal. Mm. So it was the first, I think, probably in London to be like that, where it was, and gosh, I had some marvellous times there. Absolutely amazing times.
She also probably recognised in you someone.
Oh, we became very good friends. She then moved to L'Etoile in Charlotte Street. Yeah. And her husband, Aldo, was a fascinating man as well, because they lived in Knoll Road in Islington in the 1960s. And their neighbours were a gay couple called Kenneth Halliwell and Joe Orton. And it was Aldo who, they'd heard some shouting, and then the next day they were worried, and Eleanor had said, what's up with Joe? And Aldo, and she looked through the keyhole and saw him dead. And Aldo had to break down the door, and of course Kenneth Halliwell had killed his lover and then himself. So she never forgot that. But I remember once, for example, I was having dinner there with Rowan Atkinson, my friend Rowan, the wonderful comic, great comic genius.
Lescargot,
at Lescargot, upstairs. And Rowan is the most wonderful person in the world, but he's not a late night figure at all. In those days, I quite was. So we'd had dinner, and it was like 9:30, and Rowan said, right, well, I'll get a cab and go home. And I thought, oh, well, I'll do the same. So I ordered a cab. His cab came first. And I was just about to leave, and Ellen said, could you go and cheer up John Hurt? He's just left his wife, and he's all very unhappy, and he needs a bit of cheering up.
He was eating alone.
So I sat down, and there was John Hurt, sit down. and every now and again, Ellen would say, your cab's still here, Stephen? I said, oh, tell him I'll be 5 minutes. Yeah, it's five minutes, like that. So I remember getting home, and the cab bill was £220. And I saw John about a week later and said, I've told everyone I got hurt on Thursday night. And he said, well, I told everyone I got fried. So that was our thing. I got to know him even better later because he moved to Norfolk.
Was Europe at all an influence? Did you travel to France or Italy or did you do Greece? Was there any food experience from being in Europe?
Just as I was really beginning to love food, I went with Rowan, whom I mentioned, Rowan Atkinson, had bought a new Aston Martin, and he said, I really think we should try this out. And so we booked ourselves an amazing holiday, going all the way down France through, basically, through as many three-Michelin-star restaurants. Mm-hmm. So Mionnet in outside Lyon, Alain Chappelle's restaurant, thing, and then down to the Mougins restaurants outside Cannes, and the Column d'Or, which is not three-star, but is one of the greatest restaurants in the world.
Isn't it?
Oh,
that menu. So
heavenly. For people who don't know, it's up from Cannes in the hills, and it's this beautiful, beautiful place. It's like your ideal image of a Provençal house with the tiles and everything else, but it has added to it these extraordinary pieces on the walls by Matisse and others.
And Miro.
And
there's a cauldron in the swimming pool.
That's right. These extraordinary paintings, because the original patron and his wife would allow the artists to give pictures instead of paying the bills, and it has since become one of the great restaurants of the world. Really, its atmosphere and for all its fame and the not necessarily easy to get a table, especially during the Cannes Film Festival or something, it is the friendliest, warmest place. It's really like all these good places. There, you might think they're going to be frightening.
It's the same family.
Like the River Cafe. Like, come to the River Cafe. You won't find people looking snootily at you at all. Yeah. It's the opposite of good restaurant to have snootiness, isn't it?
When I spoke to you a couple of months ago, you were talking about your schedule, and a lot of it was around being in London or being in Los Angeles.
Mm.
And I think that California is so interesting in terms of going back to Alice Walters and, you know, food farm to table and restaurants like Wolfgang Puck's Ma Maison becoming Spago, where he made pizzas, and now the very kind of healthy eating of California. And I think if we're talking about a kind of food culture, would you say that in Los Angeles you're finding a certain type of food culture?
Unquestionably. And one of the interesting things is people picture Los Angeles and they think of smart movie people, and obviously there are a lot of movie people, but the food culture is driven from below, and the smart movie people follow it. And over the last 10 years, the major thing has been street food, food trucks, which a lot of British people, when you'd say to them, oh, look, there's a fish taco truck, let's go and have that for lunch, they'll go, are you crazy, Steve? Is it hygienic? You know, I mean, this sort of weird British idea that a food truck couldn't live up to a restaurant. Yeah. And very often the queue is the indication. You'll see a big line and you'll know that's a good one, and you make a note in your head. Next time I'm driving down here, I'll go in and try what they've got. And and there's that side of things. Of course, there's the glamorous side of places
that the
movie people go. Yeah, the Polo Lounge. Yeah. And a place like Craig's now, you'll always see a Kardashian in there if you want to. and again, you know, because they're the paparazzi outside. Yeah. And what in America they call videographers, who are these...
Oh, really?
Is it called TMZ? This is kind of news channel, gossip news channel. Yeah. But the quality of food is good for... You know, good for vegans and vegetarians, and so it's a good place to say, "Oh, I'll go vegan for a week." Yeah. You know, just out of fun, really, because there's so many options.
Do you only eat out?
No, not at all. Oh, no, I love to cook, though. Yeah. I've got a really good kitchen in the house in LA, so really enjoy it. Well, it's an open. It's this long, long room because the house used to be an art gallery when it was built in 1923.
Where is it?
In it's. I don't really give too much of a detail.
Oh, sorry. Okay,
but it's under the Hollywood sign, Beachwood Canyon.
Ah, and there's an art gallery up there.
It was an art gallery. So there's this very long room, this upper room, which used to be where the pictures were. One end of it is the kitchen, and it's open to the dining room part of it and the other parts of it. So you kind of, when you're cooking, you're chatting to everybody who might be there, and there's plenty of room. It's really, there's good surfaces. You know how somehow surfaces disappear when you cook. Where can I put anything?
Do you cook there more than you would cook in here?
Yeah, I do. And I love it. And my husband's a good, a good customer. He seems to enjoy it.
If you like listening to Ruthie's Table 4, would you please make sure to rate and review the podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...with zero qualifications...
She had a Harvard plaque.
tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion.
That this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million.
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Sean, and I'm making lemon almond and polenta cake with Stephen Fry.
I am a convicted lemon almond and polenta cake user, and I was on the road to recovery, but now that's all been set back, I'm afraid.
So shall I make this?
Tell me what I need to do.
There's nothing we need to do, apart from we've got our butter here.
So that's butter just softened on its own.
I took the liberty of giving it a beat before you arrived because I thought don't need to watch that. Yeah. But as it goes from the yellow colour to the pale colour, it's your point of knowing that it's been beaten. And then you've got your 450 grams of caster sugar that goes in it. And then this is going to get beaten until the sugar dissolves.
Right. And again, I mean, it's one of the loveliest tastes in the world when I was a child, butter and sugar together.
Yeah, that's...
Just can't get enough, can you?
Exactly. So, shall I switch it on?
This is being
the noisy bit. Yeah. But you're not cold. We can talk amongst ourselves.
There we are.
It's very high-tech. Okay. Then, you know, some people will put a bit of egg and a bit of flour in it alternately, but I'm just going to...
Right.
Brazen it out, quite frankly.
Right.
I think it
all ends up in the same in the end.
Yeah.
Oh, lovely. Lovely.
This is the polenta flour and the ground almonds. So I'll just get that in, let it go around slowly so we don't get covered.
You made this one quite recently. It's still warm.
Yeah. Oh. So that's actually going to go on the menu for lunch now.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Do you want to have a piece of that?
Why not?
Do you want to cut yourself a slice?
Yeah.
Yum.
So soft.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to have to say the word moist. There's no escaping it.
Yeah, we were just... Do you want to... should I find you a fork?
I'm quite happy to just, frankly, drop my head into it and go... like that, but probably
a nice idea. Yeah, look at that. That's got a cup of tea written all over it. Or espresso. It's got espresso written all over it, hasn't it?
Mmm. Oh, my goodness.
You can have that while you talk to Ruthie.
Mmm. That is so good, honestly. Brilliant.
There we are. Thanks.
Thank you.
Nice one. Thanks.
You've just made a polenta cake with Sean. Tell me what that was like.
It was a tremendous experience. It's so simple on the one hand, but like all great dishes, it can be made better by people who are confident.
Mm.
My theory about food is that certain ingredients know when you're scared.
They know when you're scared.
Yeah. I love making mayonnaise, but it's a mood thing. If you're not quite confident enough, it knows and it will split. If you're too confident, it will split. You have to just sort of come up to it and show that you are master, but that you respect it. And I think that's true of a lot of ingredients, and polenta cake no less so, to get that gritty moisture and that sweetness and that citrus all in the right proportion. Mm. It's a simply joyous thing to eat.
I was going to also ask you about work and creating and food. So when you are writing, when you're directing, when you're doing your beautiful voice, audio books, what is your relationship to food?
I find it very hard to eat anything before a performance of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
That's as if your nerves sort of shrink you up and your metabolism is fast, which tends to reduce appetite. Anything that makes your metabolism go quick reduces appetite, doesn't it? Like cocaine, for example, with speed. The white
powder that you had when you were in boarding school.
But those drugs are appetite suppressants as opposed to the slowy down ones that can, you know, like famously cannabis gives you the munchies, you know, and so on. So aside from external forces and chemistry, the actual act of being nervous before a show, I find, has that thing that I just couldn't eat. But afterwards, yes. And that's... Everyone tells you you shouldn't eat, you know, 2 hours before bed or whatever because, you know,
I don't know if they say that anymore.
Maybe they don't.
We always look for that study that you want to read, which says that actually you gain no more weight by eating before you go to bed than you would if you had it at 6 o'clock.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
That's what I heard.
Because I am a bit obsessed about my weight. I mean, I know I'd be fitter. I would snore less and puff less at the top of the steps if I lost a
you look gorgeous
stones,
to me. Any less of Stephen Fry.
I tried that Ozempic years ago.
Oh, did you?
I'm
an
early adopter of these things.
Yeah.
And I happened to be in America and I'd read about it. And and I asked my doctor in America, my physician, as they like to call them, and he said, I think I can get you some. And he tried me on it. And the first week or so, I was thinking, this is astonishing. Not only do I not want to eat, I don't want alcohol of any kind. This is going to be brilliant. And then I started feeling sick. And then I started feeling sicker and sicker and sicker. And I was literally throwing up. Yeah. 4 or 5 times a day, and I thought, like, I can't do this.
Don't do it.
So that's it. And the new variant, tirzepatide, Mounjaro, as it's called, makes it even worse, apparently, so if you have those side effects. So I think it's probably good.
I think you look great. I think you just leave it. You are handsome and elegant, and you're eating. And so food and work, home and work.
Food and work, yes. I love to work on an empty stomach as well.
If
it's writing.
If you're writing?
Yeah, and I'm in writing mode at the moment.
What are you writing?
Well, it's the fourth in a series of books I've done on Greek mythology, and it's the final one. The first was the kind of birth of the gods and the creation of humankind and the kind of gods and the humans interacting and interbreeding. And the second one is called Heroes and is like Hercules and Perseus and Theseus and Jason and Atalanta and these, you know, the heroic race. And then the third one was the Trojan War with, you know, Achilles and Helen and all that. And this fourth one is them all coming home. Agamemnon has to come home to be murdered, and Helen and Menelaus, her husband, have to go home. I always picture that voyage home as a sort of a lot of folded arms. And you didn't try very hard to escape from Troy, did you, darling? And then, of course, the Odyssey, which is the main story of that.
Do you think the gods ate?
Ate. They did.
And what did they drink?
The gods drank nectar. Nectar, which is not quite the juice of, you know, the hollyhock or the flower, but a sort of honey and alcohol kind of thing that was good for gods. Mm. And they ate ambrosia. It was called ambrosia.
What is that?
No one's quite sure what ambrosia was, but it was the food of the gods rather than the drink of the gods. And this is what, and ambrosia kept their blood in a silvery form. The gods had silvery blood rather than red or blue or green. And it was called ichor. And if humans had ichor, if they tasted ichor or it was on them, it would kill them straight away. So it was what kept the gods very good.
Only
for the gods, yeah.
Only for the gods.
But it's a nice, one of the best words in the English language is petrichor.
What's that?
Petros is rock in Greek, as in petrol and petrify and all those things, petroleum. And ichor is that blood, that strange silvery liquid. And petrichor is the word for that smell that rises up from the earth after rain. Mm. Isn't that lovely that there's a word for it?
Yes,
and that's what it is. It's this kind of holy, sacred smell rising up from the earth.
On that note of smell and comfort, we were talking, I suppose, a lot about comfort that you've derived from your life in going to school and needing comfort in sweets or growing up later and the memories of seeking comfort. As well, before we go to lunch, what would be a food that you would go for comfort?
It's a small silvery fish in a tin. Not a sardine, although I like sardines. Mm-hmm. It's called a skipper. You see them in supermarkets. At first you go, oh, there's obviously skipjack tuna, which mm-hmm. is a different thing.
Mm-hmm. Skipjack, yeah.
But skippers are little, I don't know if there's another name for them, mm-hmm. but they are kind of boneless, so you have them whole, and they're sort of soft enough to spread on toast. Mm. And on toast, they are absolutely glorious.
Why do you
to
think
me.
That gives you comfort?
I think my mother used yeah. to get them, and that's probably what it is. I mean, it's a terrible admission, isn't it?
No,
well, it's not a terrible admission.
Most of people who answer this yeah. question will say something from their memory of sharing their yeah. mother, their father, their grandmother, the culture they came from. Thank you. What a great
Such
day.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Ruthie's Table 4 in partnership with Montclair.
Ruthie's Table 4 is produced by Atomai Studios for iHeartRadio. It's hosted by Ruthie Rogers and it's produced by Willem Malensky. This episode was edited by Julia Johnson and mixed by Nigel Appleton. Our executive producers are Faye Stewart and Zad Rogers. Our production manager is Caitlin Paramore and our production coordinator is Bella Cellini. This episode had additional contributions by Sean Wynn Owen. Thank you to everyone at the River Cafe for your help in making this episode.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.